If you're in the media game, Scott Dadich is a damn legend. He spent over a decade shaping major magazines like Texas Monthly and Wired, and now he's a partner at Godfrey Dadich Partners, a creative agency that works with clients like National Geographic and the Obama Foundation. It sounds like a huge cliche, but Scott is someone who sees the future and then actually makes it happen. The best part is that he does it all in the most humble way possible and like it's just another day getting to do his dream job. Hodinkee senior writer James Stacy and I sat down with Scott during a recent trip to San Francisco, and he really does make it sound that easy. I'm your host, Stephen Pulverant, and this is Hodinkee Radio. This week's episode is brought to you by Tudor. Stay tuned later in the show for a look at the Black Bay Chrono, a new take on one of Tudor's most iconic watches. You can also learn more at TudorWatch.com. All right. Thanks so much for being here, Scott. We really appreciate you coming on the show.
Thank you so much, Stephen. So happy to be here.
Yeah, and we have James here also, so we've got
everyone,
everybody in the room.
Great to meet you, sir.
A pleasure, for sure. Yeah, I'm excited for this.
Scott, I think our readers might have seen you recently in Volume 2 of the Hodinkee magazine, where you contributed an essay about your watch collecting, specifically Rolex collecting, and how you use watches to mark milestones in your life. How did that end up being something you were interested in doing?
Well, first of all, thank you for asking me to contribute to the magazine. That was a thrill. It's a beautiful, beautiful object.
Thank you very much.
I think as a fan of magazines and longtime maker of magazines, it's a real joy to see care and craft put into the medium and to have something to hold in your hands that's luscious and beautifully designed and well-written and gorgeously photographed. So congratulations on that.
Thank you. I will certainly take that compliment from you. Thank you.
Well, it was a thrill to do, and I was really happy to contribute the thoughts because as I wrote in the piece, it wasn't ever anything that I could envision myself participating in, the idea of collecting watches, let alone being fortunate enough to have some prize pieces from Rolex. Just sort of the origins of how I came to it and the introduction from friends and the joy and delight that I get out of collecting and wearing them and using them every day as timepieces.
Was there something about Rolex in particular that drew you in? I mean, James, I know from being around watch guys all the time, there's something about Rolex, right? That's
there
just
is,
a little different.
I wonder, I've experienced a lot of people go through phases where when they first get into watches, maybe they don't understand the appeal fully and they kind of back away from Rolex and you explore other avenues. But it does seem like if you stay in the waters long enough, you start to see a charm that's not there with a lot of other brands, especially when you consider like a length of lineage mm-hmm. of design mm-hmm. and product development and that sort of thing. I wonder if that was how you came to it or if you kind of saw it with your own eye.
I think you're right. I think that's exactly what drew me to it. I had older friends and mentors who sort of looked out for me in the early part of my career, who one was an Omega fan and just wore his Omega the length of his career. And it wasn't until I met Jacek Kozubek. And Jacek introduced me to the world of Rolex, and I remember spending a whole afternoon, I think it was 5 or 6 hours at his shop, just literally.
That's easy to do.
That's
a quick
easy
afternoon,
to do.
For
and
sure.
He was so generous and thoughtful in both describing the watch and the company and the attention to detail, and then from my side on the love of design and typography and materials and the industrial components of assembling a piece of design like that just really spoke to me. I also, from Jacek's knowledge, just the depth and experience there, the ability to talk about the thickness of typography, the color, meters first, what a red sub is, and to sort of go through all of that just as a total novice and learn that much in one afternoon. It just sort of clicked in for me, and I felt really tied to the brand and really had sort of a great affection for it right away.
Yeah, that's great. That's like being thrown right into the deep end going to talk with Jacek, but it's a good way to learn because you start kind of with the real deal. You don't have to like dip your toe in first. You get to kind of experience it in all of its minutiae and sometimes insanity and you know, kind of find your own path.
Exactly. And the level of discourse and genuine enthusiasm from him, I think, really rubbed off on me, that it was just a pure delight and affection for the work. And I think that was something that just felt really pure to me and made perfect sense with my first purchase.
And what was that purchase?
It was a 1969-1675.
Okay. That's a great watch.
Beautiful.
Good watch.
In a beautiful shape. And it was actually, he had just gotten it in a couple of days before, single owner, a guy who, Bill Brady, it's engraved on the back of the case. And it was a single owner, and he bought it in Vietnam. And wow. It actually had this really ornate handmade silver bracelet at the time. And so we swapped that for something a little bit more contemporary.
A little bit easier to wear.
A little bit easier to wear. And but the fade on it, everything was just in miraculous shape. So I fell instantly in love with it. And that was the first one.
Yeah. A GMT is a great watch. And it's a watch I think a lot of people come to a little later as well.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of, again, like that's a pretty deep end way to start, a 60s GMT.
Yeah, I think that's a few layers deeper than, like, I think subs are at the entry point. But I think, like, yeah, the GMTs, Explorer 1s, stuff like that are a little bit on the deeper side. So, I mean, it's nice that you had someone to kind of guide you in and get you to that, to a stronger point. Something that it sounds like you still have the watch. And,
I do.
And, yeah,
I
so,
do.
I mean, it's
I
found a
it.
Good home then, which is awesome. I think that, you know, a lot of the first phases of the watch collecting is buying and deciding it's not quite right and moving on to something else. And when you can have someone who can guide you through that process, it's special.
And even looking at all the subtle variants there, the color of the loom, the dials, the fading, it's just a really rich vein to dive into.
For sure. And, you know, Stephen had mentioned minutia and you had mentioned enthusiasm. And I think those things, they operate so closely in anything, cars, watches, design. These details become things that we fixate upon and attach meaning to that may not have been there even at the design, at the original design level. But it's an interesting context for a product like that to take on, you know, 40 plus years after it, after it would have, you know, met its usefulness.
And I think you feel the history in wearing it. I certainly do. The idea of bringing it into contemporary life and finding the utility and beauty in it just as an everyday thing to wear.
For sure.
Yeah, I totally agree. That idea of utility and these old things that were very purpose-driven, getting to kind of keep living their lives is really exciting in a sort of fun, silly, nostalgic way. I mean, yesterday we were shooting a review, James and I, along with our producer, Gray, and, you know, walking up into the Marin Headlands, you know, I was wearing a vintage Explorer. And there's something fun about going on a hike with an old watch that was meant for hiking that, like, now is mostly, you know, I wear it to work in the city or out to dinner. And there's something fun about, like, taking it back out into nature. It feels like you're, like, really putting it through its paces a little bit.
I love that idea. And the idea of contrast too, I think about that a lot. You know, what is the piece that you're going to wear that day? Thinking about the sneakers you're going to wear, the suit you're going to wear, a t-shirt. Like, that was another piece that I wanted to write about, that idea that of personal comfort and marking accomplishments with the way you carry yourself and the things that we tend to define ourselves with. There was something really interesting about that. And I wrote about it was not really until I brought it into everyday life and could feel comfortable wearing it with a t-shirt and not feeling like I had to get dressed up in order to wear a watch like that.
Including a gold sub, right?
Exactly. So the gold sub, that was the big one. It was an amazing watch the first time I saw it. I totally fell in love with it and was really smitten with it. And I remember also got it from Jacek, and remember talking to him about it, and he's like, are you sure you really, that's a very loud watch.
when the dealer is trying to talk you out of buying the watch, you know, it's
he's
a,
like,
a challenge.
I have other things over here. We should take a look at this. I said, no, this is definitely the one.
So, it just spoke to you?
Completely. It was, this is the silliest reason for wanting it. Have you watched Million Dollar Listing New York?
Yeah.
So Frederick Eklund wears that. I think it's a contemporary. It's a gold sub.
Oh,
and
I never noticed.
It's a beautiful piece.
And
I just sort of got interested in what it did and just sort of how it looked, and went in to see Jacek to sort of look at options there, and saw this one with this almost electric purple dial.
Oh, wow.
It's pretty nuts.
Very cool.
So I tend to wear that probably 3 or 4 times a week now.
Cool. And I can't remember, is that on a bracelet or do you wear it on a strap?
It's on a bracelet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the way to wear
blingy.
It.
It's blingy.
Yeah.
It's
that's the way to do
blingy.
It, right?
Yeah.
If you're going to have fun with it, have fun with
you
it.
You might as well.
Yeah. And there is something like fun about a gold watch in general, but especially fun about a gold sports watch, right?
Yeah.
And on the bracelet, it's like, it has like a levity to it.
Yeah, that it definitely does.
Kind of belies its original intention, but not in a way that seems to mess with its overall appeal. Like I think there, it becomes something distinct. It's cool.
Very, very well said. Yeah. I've moved the 1675 over to a strap now. And so I'd trade out NATO's on that.
Cool. Nice.
Leather and otherwise. But, the bracelet on the gold boy is really something. Yeah.
It's got some weight to it.
It does. You don't forget that you're wearing it. No. Not ever.
That would be a little hard.
Yeah. Without question.
People obviously can't see through the podcast, but you're not wearing a vintage Rolex today.
I am not, actually. This is, I love this watch. A friend of mine obviously worked on it at Apple, and so I think of him when I wear this. He's a wonderful designer and dear friend. But this has been great for the gym, and I went to the gym this morning, so it was one of those that sort of, it prompts me. The health utility of it, I think, has been really interesting. I found less utility for it in the early days, and I think the more that they've tuned in watchOS to really sort of prompt and identify the benefits of your workouts and keeping moving and standing. I really enjoy that. So I wear this a few times a week now.
So that includes like you find the metrics for like step counting and telling you to get up and move around. That's helpful in your lifestyle?
It definitely is. And especially, you know, in the last year, the sort of nature of my work has changed in being in a lot more client meetings and presentations and a lot more computer work. And instead of sort of the roaming the newsroom that I did at Wired. And so the prompt to get up and move my ass and go do something else, and especially to go to get to the gym and feel a little bit better about myself maybe once or twice a week.
For sure.
Yeah. It's funny. You mentioned that watchOS has changed substantially. And I think that's something that people who don't kind of stay up on the Apple Watch or who haven't been wearing them miss. But I remember, you know, when it first came out, it was really about notifications. It was about bringing apps to your wrist. It was a lot more
texting kind of, and emails.
It sounds kind of redundant, but like active interactions. Whereas now it feels a lot more like it's about passive interactions and monitoring and reminders.
It feels consumptive. Like it does feel like a little mini dashboard that just sort of gives me quick indicators of what's going on, which I do enjoy, especially if I know I'm going to be in meetings all day and I don't want to be rude and pull out the phone and in front of folks. I can sort of take that quick glance and get a sense of what's going on.
Do you ever do the one on each wrist?
I've never done that, thank God. Have you seen that? Is that a thing?
I've seen it a couple times. Wow.
Jack, our esteemed editor in chief, likes to pull that move from time to time.
There ought to be a name for that, right?
I don't know.
Probably there should be. We should come up with something.
Yeah, that's definitely
Jack. That's your job now.
I'm
gonna call you out right now. You got to come up with something.
He's pulling a blank.
Yes, exactly.
There you go.
All right, you have homework, Jack. As far as the industrial design, I mean, you mentioned you know somebody on the design team. What is it about the industrial design of that product that appeals to you? I mean, it's in many ways the total opposite of the industrial design of something like a Rolex, and then
it is
in other ways kind of similar, I guess.
I think there's something really elegant about it. It's I'm wearing the white ceramic one right now, the Series 2. And when that came out, I was just totally smitten with the design. The high contrast black and white, I think, is really special. And I love the bands, the silicone bands, the sort of white on white. It reminds me of the early days of the iPod.
Yeah.
Has that sort of clarity and the sort of bright signal that high contrast black and white carries with it.
Yeah, I agree. I wish you could put those rubber sport bands on other watches.
Right?
They're so good.
They're pretty great.
They might be my favorite. Other than Rolex bracelets, they might be my favorite straps in
they
watches.
They have the benefit of the strap slides under itself. So if you work at a computer all the time and you have that problem that I think a lot of people have where you hate your touching the MacBook, like the metal of the MacBook.
The little clinking.
Yeah, exactly. Or just it's kind of that rubbing, especially on the sharp edge on the MacBook. Like it kind of like it tweaks a bit, but with the rubber and no buckle.
I think they've done a magnificent job with the colorways.
I agree.
With the white, I mean, they're really sort of out there and moving moving the culture forward and thinking about use of color and color story. I think they've done a really brilliant job of that.
I agree completely. I'm just waiting for a white ceramic iPhone.
Oh, that's yes. Ooh, that would be nice, wouldn't it?
It'd be so good. Just take all my money now. And
have you seen the new Red 8?
I have.
iPhone 8, that's a really beautiful piece of design.
It's really cool. It's something that when I first saw pictures of it, I wasn't into it. Mm-hmm. And then the first time I saw one in person, I was kind of like, I might be able to get behind this.
It actually caused me to think about giving up the 10 for a little bit.
Really?
Just because I love that anodized red. It was so handsome. I had the 7 in the red, but that had the white frame around the screen. Yeah. So you had that white, black, red thing that I didn't love as much, but the new one with the black face is quite handsome.
It's cool. So obviously we know that you collect Rolex as a way to mark milestones. Are there other things you collect?
I have become a bit of a sneakerhead.
Okay.
This was...
It's a deep hole.
This is deep hole.
I'm kind of like right on the precipice, so maybe you'll push me over the edge here. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
It's really dangerous. My colleague, Rob Capps, who is the editorial director at Wired and is now our partner and head of editorial at our firm, we have been debating this in the office, and there's just been some back and forth about sneakers and what are you wearing. Rob wears the Janoski, and so we were going back and forth about this. I'm wearing the new Jordan 3 Tinker Hatfield edition, the ones that Timberlake was wearing at the Super Bowl today, and I got those yesterday, and Rob and I were going back and forth about the great perils of sneaker collecting. But get ready to turn over a whole closet and tens of thousands of dollars to the habit.
All right. What are some of your favorite sneakers these days, other than the ones you're wearing?
Well, I came to it in my research for the Tinker Hatfield episode of Abstract.
Right.
I had known of Tinker and just thought the world of him, and he was right up at the top of our casting when we were producing the first season. There's such a fervor and fanaticism, I think for some of the same reasons and that I identify with collecting watches or Rolexes. Color, material, the line work, the sort of formal values of the sneaker, I think speak to different people in different ways. What is beautiful to me isn't to everybody else. And I love that about it. I love the sort of diversity of entry points. So in researching the episode and working with Tinker, I got to go to the kitchen at Nike with Tinker and be on campus with him for multiple weeks as we were filming. And it just sort of rubs off on you. You just sort of can't help but find yourself immersed in it. And as a designer, it just, all of those elements came together in thinking about possibility and performance and the sort of cultural values of sneakers and the very, very rich history and what sneakers say to people, both about their personal values and their personal outlook.
And would you say, like, before that experience with Tinker, you wouldn't have had the context to have understood the aesthetic?
I think that's right. I remember being in school when Jordans were a thing, and
sure,
it was a lust-worthy object. And I remember the kids who had them and being so deeply envious of them. But it was not something that I could understand, I think, in the current context, my adult and contemporary context. It was really the education, again, that Tinker gave me, sort of being able to be around him and have him explain some of the choices that he made and why he made them. Like on the original Air Max, cutting that little window in the foam to show the air was influenced by the Centre Pompidou and Renzo Piano, Richard Rogers design. The idea of putting the inside of the building on the outside and making the normally invisible visible. And that was the influence that drove him to make that decision. Once you know those things, it's really wonderful to think about. And he always comes to it from a sense of story. Mm-hmm. And so he'll talk about this, and he talks about it in the episode quite a bit, the stories of his work with MJ and thinking about the decisions around these meetings and the events surrounding MJ's career and thinking about color choice and materiality and being late for a meeting, influencing a choice that he made, even in the Jordan 3. So there's just so much there and such richness to the context.
Yeah. Do you like to keep your sneakers pristine and kind of in their original boxes and up on a shelf, or are you a kind of wear them, beat them up, live with them kind of devil may care?
I do a little bit of both.
Okay.
I've been so fortunate that Tinker has given me a couple of very rare pairs that are, I'm actually having a couple of cases fitted out.
Very nice.
Acrylic UV protection so that there'll be little, little vitrines in the office that I'm very proud to show those couple off. Including the original Earl, the white employees only, hyper adapt. So I've worn those a couple times, but I think they're going into a glass case.
Okay. Yeah. Pull them out for special occasions.
Exactly. Exactly. And then another dear friend of mine, a guy named Steve Stout, introduced me to sort of more contemporary collecting. And I wear those shoes, and I have probably about a dozen.
Okay.
That a range of designers and thinking about different use cases, and the ones that I wear to Giants ball games or something that I'll wear with a suit end up being pretty different.
Okay. Is there any pair right now that's like a new release, like around this summer, that you think is like the hot shoe right now?
I just picked up a pair of the Air Max 270s.
Okay.
Have you guys seen those?
I haven't.
It's the one with the really tall, big air bladder under the heel.
Okay.
And it's fully transparent around the entire outside.
I think I have seen this. Okay. Yeah.
And the colorways are really interesting. There's sort of a three component system to the shoe. Where it's sort of a fly knit upper, and then this sort of harder rubber encasement around the heel and midsole. And each one of those can be colored in a different way. I just picked up a pair. They're all white except for the heel cup is like tennis ball neon optic yellow.
Oh, cool.
So it's very high contrast, white laces, white upper. And
these are the 270s?
These are the 270s.
Okay.
Very cool.
We might have to go sneaker shopping after
this. I think
this.
You
sounds
should.
Wild. Yeah,
I think
sure.
You should. The Nike sneakers app. Highly recommend it.
All right.
One slightly insider question for Tinker is I watched the episode and loved it, but I did notice he's wearing an uncommon watch, a Helsin Gauge, I believe.
Oh, good eye.
And that's an interesting piece. And
this
is not
why we keep James around.
Yeah. Well,
I hadn't even
noticed that.
Yeah, just I didn't know if you found him, like if he was watch interested or if that was more like he connected with the design. It's a distinctive design and one that I've always really liked. And Helsin makes a variety of designs, but that gauge was always one of their kind of clearest, I would think most successful designs. And it's fun just to kind of see it, especially on the arm of a designer.
Yeah, I haven't asked him about that. I last time I was with him, he was wearing, it had sort of a rubberized band with a Jordan Jumpman on it.
Oh, cool.
So he's definitely got some specific, some customizations.
I love it.
As Tinker would.
Yeah, for sure.
And as a design guy, I know you're also interested in kind of furniture and graphic design. Do you collect in those spaces at all, either?
I've started to get a little bit more wise in the furniture department. A friend of mine recommended, I've been wanting an Eames lounge for a very long time.
Yeah.
And my friend connected me with a guy who was selling a 1956 Series 1. And so that was a very happy acquisition.
That's a chair right there.
late last year that I picked up. Then I probably had the problem of moving, and now I don't have the place to feature it prominently. I love art. Christoph Niemann is another artist whose art I've been collecting now for more than 10 years. And as he's produced screen prints and originals, I've collected a few of his. And then in books, I definitely, because of my love for graphic design, back from the earliest days of working at Texas Monthly, collecting type specimens from turn of the 18th, 19th century all the way through contemporary design moments and thinking about first editions and rare books. And I definitely find myself when I'm traveling, I'm looking for great bookstores, art bookstores, where I can sort of rummage around and find something special.
And now a word from our sponsor. Over the last couple of years, Tudor's made a real name for themselves with their Heritage Collection. These are watches that have old-school styling, but are built using real modern watchmaking. One of these watches is the Black Bay Chrono.
It's a very distinctive design. You know, you're crossing the lines between a dive watch and a typical kind of racy chronograph, and I think they've done really well with it.
Yeah, you've got all those Tudor features, like the distinctive snowflake hands, but then under the hood is a manufacturer caliber, the MT5813, which is both chronometer certified and has a silicon balance spring.
For sure. Easy wearing, it looks great, and a great movement.
If you want to see one of these for yourself, you can go visit your local authorized retailer, or you can go to TudorWatch.com to learn more. Let's get back to the show. So you mentioned your start at Texas Monthly, and I think a lot of people identify you with Wired and more kind of specialty media, I guess, or enthusiast media. But you started at a massive general interest publication that really has to cater to. I'm also from Texas. I don't know if you know that.
I don't know that.
Yeah, I'm from Austin.
Oh, look at that.
Yeah,
well
so
done.
It's a publication that has to cater to a really diverse audience in a large state and feel kind of intimate to all of those people. Mm-hmm. How did that training kind of impact the later parts of your career or kind of the trajectory of your career?
That's a great question. I first want to ask you, how did you first come to Texas Monthly in your time in Austin?
How did I first come to it? I guess it was just always there. It was like, you know, on every shelf at HEB grocery stores and, you know, just always something that was around. And as long as I've been aware of magazines, you know, just like people would say, oh, did you see this thing in the New York Times? Did you see this thing in the Wall Street Journal? In Texas, it really is like another flagship publication like that. It's something that people are referencing all the time.
I'm so glad to hear you say that, because that is so often the case, and it was for me too. I just remember it just existing.
Just
I remember my parents picking it up at the checkout aisle at the grocery store. It was just like, it was the thing. It was just, it existed. And I grew up in Lubbock, Texas. Mm. And I was lucky enough that when I was in design school at Texas Tech University, one of the alum, a guy named DJ Stout, who was the art director of Texas Monthly, came to talk one day. And I didn't even really get, I was probably a sophomore, 19, 20 years old, in design communications. And DJ came in and just showed his work. He showed his doodles, his sketches, talked about what it meant to be an art director, to work with illustrators and photographers and editors and journalists, and put all those elements together into a journalistic package, into a magazine package. And for me, it just sort of clicked in, and I formed a friendship with DJ, and he mentored me to the extent that I ended up getting his job. And as he left and joined Pentagram as a partner, vouched for me with Evan Smith, the editor at the time. And I found my way into it. It was just the most perfect click in for me of my interests, my pride as a Texan, and my love of story. And at 22 years old, found myself the art director of Texas Monthly, this thing that had just always existed for me.
Right.
And I felt sort of protective of it. And I felt this great burden of responsibility or mantle of responsibility being placed on me. I was there for probably 6.5 years working for Evan.
Okay.
And he taught me how to be a journalist. It was really, I didn't go to school for it, but Evan and the team there and all of my colleagues, all the great editors and writers around me taught me how to write and edit and think critically in that context. And for Texas Monthly, it was the context of Texas. And I think one of the great gifts of that magazine is it does serve the state, but also the country. And so many important stories have come out of that title. I think of people like Pamela Koloff, who's gotten multiple people off of death row through her work. Yeah. And at the same time, it can go and profile the best barbecue joints. And it really is meant to be highly inclusive. It's for red and for blue. It's for the issues of the state and the country and the world. And thinks really, it thinks highly of itself, and for good reason, because it is so important to so many people.
Yeah.
In terms of the context and what that meant for me, it helped me transition into Wired when I came out to the West Coast in 2006.
And so you went right from Texas Monthly to Wired.
I did. So
it's a big change.
It was a big change. I was sort of looking for a perch at a national title. I felt that I had learned what I needed to learn out of that context, and I was really looking for a big challenge, and had gone through some interviews at a couple of books in New York that didn't work out. And I one day I got this phone call, would I be interested in interviewing for the creative director job? And it was a couple month process, and I ended up accepting the job. And it was interesting. Wired, in a way, is almost the exact same magazine as Texas Monthly. If you think about it from, it can cover anything through a specific lens. And Texas Monthly did the same thing. Texas Monthly could talk about just about any story as it pertained to or affected Texas. And Wired was founded in a similar context, that it could cover and look at just about any topic as long as it was influenced or viewed through the lens of technology. And that changed a bit over time, and I tried to change it even more as editor-in-chief. But that was really sort of the founding set of principles. And Kevin Kelly, the founding executive editor, talked about it as a letter sent back from the future. And that's both a narrow and specific context, but it also allows you to think in a fairly broad format about what it's able to do in terms of coverage.
That's interesting. It's so funny to hear you say that in some ways those magazines are the same magazine with different contexts. It's I can't imagine having thought of that on my own. You know, that's such an interesting kind of out of left field perspective, but once you say it, it makes total sense.
Did you find that the skill set that you developed in Texas transferred well to the West Coast and to Wired and such?
I did. I felt I was terrified taking that job. Absolutely terrified.
That's a good sign.
That's how you know it's the right job.
Yeah, exactly.
I first came to Wired. Unlike Texas Monthly, I remember very specifically the first moment that I came to know Wired and encountered it at Book People Bookstore there at what is that, 6th and Lamar? In Austin. So I had this very finite sense of it and its importance. And so when I got there, I thought, there's no way I can do this. But what I very quickly discovered, that the set of editors were just as smart and just as committed and just as willing to help me succeed, and that my confidence soared when I could understand that the broader and more inclusive the view of the work we were doing, the more that I was going to find success and opportunity there. And it sort of manifested itself in really simple ways, like the kinds of stories we would do, the packages, the inventiveness of infographics, and the kinds of photo shoots we like doing, and the length of stories, and the investment and quality concerns that were sort of front and center in actually making it. So there was enough similar that I felt really well prepared and really well embraced by the team there.
And how would you, you talk about the publication kind of changing under your direction. How would you describe that change? You know, what do you think it was before, and then what do you think it kind of became as you kind of shaped it?
So when I took over from the editor-in-chief that I worked for as creative director, a guy named Chris Anderson. Every editor puts their own mark on the book, and Chris's was focused on areas that he was interested in. That included 3D manufacturing, additive manufacturing, drones, his personal economic theories around long tail, or the book that he wrote, Free, which introduced the idea of freemium. And Chris also taught me a lot. And so I understood that I could sort of put a bit of my own personal top spin on the work. But what I wanted to do, and I was charged with, was growing it significantly.
Okay.
I wanted to expand people's view into it, because as we saw with the arrival of the iPhone, the idea of technology and the way technology was changing our lives was really going mainstream. And that adoption of technology was something we just saw rocket ahead, just sort of a huge amount of growth there. So what we wanted to do was expand people's definition of it and their ability to look into it and see themselves or the issues that they cared about and the way that the world was changing. So that was actually part of the strategy work that my now business partner, Patrick Godfrey, led. I was interviewing firms as I took over as editor-in-chief in late 2012, early 2013, to both help us unify the newsrooms. At the time, that the founders sold the title. They sold the website and the magazine to two different organizations. So Condé Nast bought the magazine.
Wow.
And Lycos bought the website.
That sounds like a logistical nightmare.
Yes. And so Condé Nast ended up buying the website back in late 2006, early 2007.
Okay.
This was one of the first content sites on the internet. It ran the very first banner ad on the internet.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Sorry about that. there was such history there. And sadly, it was sitting on a single hard drive in this closet in Baltimore. It was this Whoa. Rickety, crazy, such history there. Anyway, long story, the mandate to sort of bring the two together had involved these two cultures. And so you had the old Lycos team and now becoming the Wired.com team, and just the idea of unifying it in principle just to be Wired mm-hmm. and not to be defined by the platform it goes to, that Wired ideas can populate across the web or social or video or live events or the magazine itself. And so I needed some help there. And that was where I started interviewing firms and ended up settling on this firm called Godfrey Q, and the lead strategist there, a guy named Patrick Godfrey. And Patrick ended up, and Danielle Bird, his head of planning, Patrick and Danielle ended up building this strategy that didn't include the word technology. It was about where tomorrow is realized, that idea that the ideas that Wired champions can extend well past technological applications. So I think that was part of what allowed us to grant the set of permissions to the editors, designers, producers, art directors to have as diverse a set of coverage that you could have Serena Williams on the cover, you could have Edward Snowden on the cover, and you could have President Obama on the cover. Mm-hmm. It sort of rationalized and made sense for us inside of the newsroom, and that's really what allowed us, I think, to grow so significantly over the 4 years that we were doing that.
And that Snowden cover is it's pretty incredible.
For sure.
That was a wild one.
I would imagine.
That was pretty amazing. I put that in the top three career moments.
What would the other two top career moments be?
I think the whole period of working on the iPad apps, both at Wired and then with David Remnick at The New Yorker, mm-hmm. Was something I'll never forget and am so, so proud of, and building the team that led that change at Condé Nast. I work with many of them still today.
Okay.
That group of individuals is just so special, and some of my dearest friends and family members now. And then working with President Obama, I can't say enough about what a wonderful experience that was. His staff at the White House, him personally, I will never forget a moment of that experience, set of experiences, really.
And would you say those experiences mirrored the... At some stage of those experiences, did you feel that same sort of trepidation that you felt when you were moving to go to Wired in the first place?
Absolutely.
Did you kind of chase that?
Absolutely.
Is that how you kind of touched down on knowing you were making good decisions?
I think that's right. I haven't thought about it in that context of chasing discomfort, but that might be a common theme here. With the iPad in particular, I remember we created a whole vision demo for what we believed a digital magazine ought to be before the iPad came out. And we went to Apple. This is the craziest story. Wow. We went to Apple with this whole mock-up thing. Like, if you guys were going to make a big tablet device that sort of looked like a big stretched out iPhone, we think that content ought to look like this. And there was just lots of, oh, very interesting, very interesting. And I talked to a friend of mine who's now at Apple who was in that room. He said, that was really quite something. So yeah, a bit of discomfort thinking about how we try to do those things.
You talk about this idea that you wanted Wired to be more inclusive. We deal with this conflict all the time internally, which is, we have a core base audience of people who are diehard watch lovers.
They're
enthusiasts. Yeah. They're the real nerds, we'll mm-hmm. call them, you know? Mm-hmm. And we want to serve that audience. That mm-hmm. that's kind of where we grew from. It's where many of us fall into that category. And we want to make sure that we're providing things that are compelling and interesting to those folks. But we also want to grow who can kind of come in contact with our mm-hmm. products and our stories and our brands and come to have an appreciation and can learn and can grow and can have touch points. Even if they read one Hodinkee story a year, hopefully that's a good experience for them and they get something out of it. And it's always this idea of balancing those two things. How do you create stories that are interesting to both of those audiences mm-hmm. on a consistent basis and build a brand that's interesting to both mm-hmm. those audiences? Mm-hmm. How did you think about that as you grew Wired to make sure that you really wired something that grew out of a very distinct culture? Mm-hmm. How did you balance those things, I guess?
It's a great question. I think one of the things that never gets solved, it's always on sort of rumbling question as an editor, as a designer, someone who makes stories. For us, we ended up attacking that problem with a set of values that Patrick had identified through our strategic process. We had a problem as a group of looking at an opportunity and describing it with one word, Wired. Is this story Wired? Is this cover Wired? Is that cover line Wired enough? Is that advertising package with that partner Wired for us? It was something that was sort of an ongoing question.
And is that more of, were you developing that more as a framework or as a general philosophy to understand?
A general philosophy as a collection of editors and magazine makers, there was sort of a voracious appetite to learn. That place is just built with intellectual horsepower and people who are curious about the way that the world works. That curiosity is fundamental. And so by nature, you can be curious about just about anything. And so that ended up informing that question, is this Wired? I don't know, is Edward Snowden a Wired story? Absolutely. Is Serena Williams looking at values of gender and inclusion in sports, is that Wired? Well, yeah, by our definition, it was. We were saying the same thing, but we actually meant different things under the hood of that question. And so what Patrick and Danielle did for us was identify these four values. Is the story unapologetic? Is it optimistic? Is it authoritative? We could actually go in and assess the particulars of that story and look at the lead of a story. We could look at a photograph. Is that an authoritative take? Is that an optimistic take? And actually test the values against the work we were doing. And if we were lacking, we knew we had other work to do to sort of bring it up to that standard. And so what the values did was replace Wired with almost a new vocabulary. We could actually make true assessments and look at each other and agree on the outcome. And that ended up helping us, I think, both expand and also lock into the kinds of stories that we wanted to do that were beyond just the sort of air quotes technology coverage that we would see as just sort of commodity.
Mm-hmm. And it also kind of speaks directly to the type of audience. You know, is your audience optimistic? Is your audience, you know, it's an interesting kind of two-way philosophy that I think is probably that's where you find the growth is by not connecting directly with people who you already were talking to.
Exactly.
But connecting with a type of reader that would share a mindset that would see the value of the work and understand the framework and the philosophy behind
exactly.
it.
Exactly. And I think we see that in particular, optimism was one of those that we really were able to harness both because
you can see
of
the work for sure.
Yeah, thank you. Because of being here in San Francisco in the Valley, people who participate in changing the future believe they can make a difference. I will butcher the Chomsky quote, but that ended up being really at the center of the work that we were trying to do mm-hmm. about participating in positive change. I think designers in particular try to do that because they believe they can go and make and create solutions for a better tomorrow.
Yeah. I think this is interesting in the context of Wired, and then additionally interesting because now you're working with Patrick and you're working on other brands. And
yep.
so, you know, lately at Patrick Goffrey, at Goffrey Dadich, you've worked with some pretty iconic brands, some brands that I think everybody knows, things like National Geographic.
Yep.
And you've also launched new brands, so yep. with David Chang, Major Domo Media. How do you think about that kind of structure when you're approaching both an established brand and a new brand?
That's a great question. And we've actually been informed by that process that Patrick ran with me and the team at Wired. And we learned a lot from that. I think the chocolate and peanut butter of of my side, the editorial and design function of making magazines and making content. On Patrick's side, the importance of brand and rigor around strategy and putting those two things together was sort of the founding set of ideas that we built the firm on. And it helped us, and it was in particular when we got the call from our friends at Nat Geo, Emmett Smith and Susan Goldberg, that we were able to sit down with them and talk about how we did it. And it was just really about experience, about having done it and having done the reps and lived the values and built them into the journalism itself, that we were able to talk about the way that Nat Geo was changing and looking at its 130th anniversary and the idea that exploration isn't just about the physical world. It's about exploring ideas and looking at things like race and gender and athleticism. That too is exploration. Just as we're continuing to find new ways to map the earth and beyond. And so that assignment actually started as a strategy assignment to develop a new kind of editorial strategy to help them see their work in a common language across the website and the magazine and the channel and events. And it was coming out of that Emmett emailed us one afternoon and just said, hey, what do you think about redesigning the book and rethinking what it is we do?
That's a hell of a phone call.
It was an amazing afternoon, and Emmett's become a dear friend and really valued partner. And it was just one of those dream assignments. With Dave, it's been one of those equally ambitious ongoing conversations. I got to know him. I invited him to write for Wired in 2013. And he contributed a great essay about MSG for our first food issue. And then we just stayed in touch. He spoke at an event called Wired by Design up at Skywalker Ranch. And then wrote for the magazine a few more times after that. We just really enjoyed it. He obviously had Lucky Peach at about the same time. So my time as editor-in-chief of Wired coincided with his time working on Lucky Peach and starting that. And as he was winding that down and I was thinking about leaving Wired, we were just in touch and said, let's just keep talking about what goes on and think about new ways that we can continue to collaborate. And in particular, the work with Netflix, I think, really bound us together in thinking about the power of story to ask really thoughtful questions and drive culture forward and uncover new truths, whether it was about the way people look at food in Ugly Delicious or the way people look at the world around them in abstract, and try and bring that sort of big lens to big topics. And we compared notes. I was sort of finishing abstract with my co-creators, Dave O'Connor and Morgan Neville, and then Morgan was moving off of abstract to go start working on Ugly Delicious with Dave. So it's like this whole universe of people coming together around the same set of questions, more than answers. And for us, it's very much about what does a media brand for curious people look like in the next decade? How are we going to think about telling stories in contexts like this, like sitting around with a couple of microphones and or the sort of high production values of 8 hours on Netflix? And what's the spectrum look like in between those two events? And how do we create business models around that and keep doing it and keep engaging people in really meaningful ways?
Yeah. That's another interesting thing that kind of, we can sit here and talk about telling great stories and designing great products all we want, but at the end of the day, you know, we're not all charities. Like we have to make money and we have to, you know, these are businesses, whether it's Hodinkee or whether it's National Geographic. How do you think about the changing business conditions of media as you build these new products? I mean, you were apologizing a minute ago for the first banner ad, but the way that media businesses make money is rapidly changing. Where do you see these things going?
Well, it's interesting, I think, for us three sitting in this room to be living in the transition. I certainly have friends and colleagues who were able to close out their careers before this drastic set of changes in the heyday. Thinking about the prime days of two martini lunches and at the Four Seasons Grill.
Must have been nice.
Wait, it must have been nice. I think it is.
I don't think
we do that anymore. It was, it's a profound set of changes. I think it's really exciting because it's forcing some real innovation. We opened talking about your magazine. I think it's exciting to see a concentration and a commitment to values of quality. And I think the best and most successful in this new era are pursuing it with the same sort of models in mind, regardless of the medium. And the fact that looking at the success of the Times, looking at paid models, some of my favorite media platforms now are paid. And mm-hmm. in some cases, I'm happy to pay to great expense because they're really good and they provide great value to me. And they're narrow enough that they don't need to compete with a lot of other folks. And yet they provide a great value to the readership or to the audience. I'm thinking about Ben Thompson's email Stratechery, mm-hmm. which is must read for me every morning. And I'm happy to pay Ben the $130 a year to get that newsletter delivered into my inbox. 2 years ago, if you had told me that some of my favorite media brands are in email format, I would have told you you're crazy. But I think it's that set of conditions that is so exciting for the team at Major Domo, thinking about the way we push this forward, the new kinds of models that we're going to try, and some are not going to work and some are. But the willingness of audiences to pay in other models than just consuming advertising, and the idea that it was free, is and was false. There was payment. It was just applied in a different kind of way. So I'm excited to see the models emerge and follow the folks who are charting the course.
Yeah. Do you think that you mentioned experimentation? Do you think that favors kind of small up-and-coming media brands over the larger players who might be less willing to take those risks? Or do you think some of the larger players can afford to take those risks and might end up winning out?
You see the spectrum. I think it's both and. I like the position that we are in, both at Godfrey Dadich in helping those brands and helping organizations reach audiences in new ways. That's so much of what we're about and the work that we're able to do with our partners. And I'm also really excited to be part of Major Domo and thinking about inventing that future state. I think the challenge, as we see this across broadcast, cable, magazines, digital, these organizations are tied to business models that are in transition in one way or another. Mm-hmm. And dollars are moving in different ways than they used to. And the very nature and expense of advertising is so dynamic that it's going to prove a continued challenge for those who aren't willing to disrupt their own businesses.
Sounds like the watch industry.
Yeah, sounds very much like the watch industry in a lot of ways. I think, as you said, new ways of reaching customers, new ways mm-hmm. of reaching readers, new ways of telling stories, new ways of making ideas exciting for people. Mm-hmm. Opens up lots of opportunity, but also comes with a lot of challenges.
We see that every day. And I think one of the most significant changes, certainly in my work as a designer and an editor, is the notion that a collection of people with a common set of ideas or values can be reached by a media title or by an organization or a platform or a brand, whether that's the Obama Foundation or National Geographic. You sort of think about and look at the needs of those audiences in consistent ways, and the delivery of those messages is also highly consistent. And so there's an opportunity for brands to be publishers. And it sort of harkens back to where some of this started before interruptive advertising, where there's a collection of people with a common set of ideas and, mm-hmm. and a great communication pattern. IBM had a magazine started in 1934 called Think. It was a beautiful magazine. They published it more than 60 years.
Wow.
And it had poetry and spoke in favor of globalism and free trade. And it was just about promoting a worldview and a world that IBM wanted to live in, started by Thomas Watson. It's an amazing title, and I think there's a lot of opportunity for brands, especially, to connect with their audiences on these new kinds of platforms.
So what is coming next for you?
We have a lot going on.
Some that you can talk about and some that you can't,
some that
sure.
we can't. I think one of the more frustrating things about the new job, the new firm, is we are getting to work on some incredible projects that I can't talk about for probably 4 or 5 years.
Wow.
They're very much at the intersection of what we were doing at Wired in terms of coverage, but also thinking about design challenges. And they center on the way people interact with AI in particular.
Okay.
And so that work is really, really exciting and ongoing. And we probably won't see that publicly for at least a few more years. On the media side, we've got a few new TV projects that we're spooling up, especially in conjunction with Dave and Majordomo, that we're out pitching right now, and a couple green lights coming in. So that's really exciting, thinking about creating anew in that format. I really enjoyed making Abstract with Dave and Morgan, and hope to be able to talk about new things in that area especially.
Cool. Well, we're running out of time. I think we could probably sit here and talk for another hour or two.
This has been a blast.
Yeah, this is great. So we're going to end every episode with a cultural recommendation. So I think we'll start with you, Scott. I'm putting you on the spot here.
Man.
But you should feel free to plug something great that you've worked on. You shouldn't feel obligated to plug something else.
Something that I've worked on? I'm really impressed and proud of Dave's new podcast.
The Dave Chang Show.
The Dave Chang Show. New episodes every week, Thursdays, on your favorite podcast platform. Dave's doing an amazing job there. Again, speaking of someone who's curious about the way that the world works, he just has such a thoughtful and unique set of experiences, and great guests. We've got Alan Yang on there. He had Ryan Johnson on, many more folks in the pipeline. It's a really cool way to get into Dave's brain, learn a lot more about the restaurant and food business, and really interesting and thoughtful conversations about where culture is going. So highly recommend Dave Chang Show.
Yeah,
iTunes podcast.
I've been listening also. I think it's pretty great.
I'm going to have to add that.
All right.
That sounds
great. Something for all three of us.
There we go.
Perfect.
Do you have another recommendation, James?
I do. Mine's a book.
Okay.
I'm a huge fan of Outside Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
Have been for a long
Me
time.
Too.
And they recently published a compendium of all of their misadventure. So it's some of the finest writing, in my opinion,
oh,
that they ever
awesome.
Put out. But they went back through, they're celebrating their 40th year. They did a photo book that was also fantastic
cool.
of some of their best photography from over 40 years. But I love a collection of essays because I don't have a lot of time to sit down and read. You know,
mm-hmm.
I have stacks of books in my office that I probably won't get to in the foreseeable future. But this one is called Out There, and it's a collection of these relatively short essays that were published in the magazine at some point in the last 40 years. And every story, like, there's no through line, except it's an adventure of some sort that didn't go well. It's not a disaster. It's not into thin air.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like things didn't go that great.
Mishaps.
Exactly. Aplenty. And it's really, really fantastic.
What is that called?
Out There.
Okay. I've got to pick that up.
Steven?
I'm going to go with some music. We'll go with Janelle Monáe's Dirty Computer.
Mm-hmm. I don't know about this either.
It is so good. She's such an interesting person. She's a musician. She's an actress. She's doing basically anything she can artistically and doing it all really well. And this album it's definitely the most poppy thing she's done,
mm-hmm.
And probably the most accessible, but I think also in some ways the most profound.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a way for her to get her ideas out there in a way that more people can maybe, you know, kind of get their teeth into. I think it's probably going to clean up the Grammys this year. I hope so, at least.
Okay.
But I highly recommend listening to it. It's super fun. It's super smart. It gets better and better. I've been listening to it pretty nonstop lately.
Going right in the queue.
Yeah.
Good
Love
recommendation.
It. Love it.
Great.
Thank you.
Awesome. Well, thanks
Thank
so much
so
for being
much.
Here, Scott. This is a true
been
pleasure.
A blast.
And we'll have to get you back on again sometime soon.
I'd be delighted. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you to Scott and to James for joining us. This week's episode was produced by Grayson Korhonen and was recorded at Disher Music and Sound in San Francisco, California. Please remember to subscribe and rate the show. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.